I was just thinking, I think it's because we were standing, at least in part, is why the song service sounded so good there at the end. I think part of it is our posture. I think part of it is that we know the song really well, and we've sung it many, many times. I think part of it is that we are singing about a subject that we like. But certainly singing about heaven is a blessing. And we are privileged to have the opportunity to sing about heaven and anticipate the time when we'll be singing in heaven. What a wonderful opportunity that will be for us. I want to talk about earthly things for a little bit today, and maybe singing about heaven is a good way to segue into that. The things of earth are sometimes described as being heavenly, a heavenly dessert or a heavenly what? And I've mentioned this before. It's a burr under my saddle these days. There are spiritual things on earth that have heavenly ramifications, and I think that that's fine. If you want to talk about a heavenly worship service or a heavenly relationship with your brethren, I think that's great. I think it's appropriate. But earthly things are earthly. The good things that are earthly are earthly, and we need to appreciate that, and especially since so many of these earthly things are not heavenly in any sense. They are not only carnal by their nature, they are objectionable by their nature. We wish they did not exist, and we are forced to tolerate them in the short term, and maybe depending on the thing that you're tolerating, you may not think of it as being short term. Anything having to do with this earth ultimately is short term. I think we would all agree with that in concept. You're not going to have to deal with this forever because you're not going to be here forever. So in that sense, everything is short term. Now, it may not feel like short term if you're dealing with this for 10 whole minutes, you know, or 10 days or 10 years. It may not seem like a temporary sort of thing. But we need to remember that the things of this earth, including and particularly the objectionable ones, that we have to tolerate, they will come and go. And in the meantime, what we need to do is build up a resistance. And we do that by deliberately choosing to build up a resistance. And so I ask the question here, what can you tolerate? And I'm going to flip this a little bit here at the end. But first of all, I want to talk about things like pain, for instance. Things that are objectionable, things that we have to put up with. I'm having a Steve Hartzog moment here. By defining the word tolerate, allow the existence, occurrence, or practice of something that does not necessarily, that one does not necessarily like or agree with, without interference. And the without interference is the catch there, I think. We are tolerating the difficulties of this life because we don't have any choice, in a sense. But in a sense, we do have a choice. You can tolerate, like this is talking about, just accept it and move on, or you can whine about it. You can complain about it. You can fuss about it. You can pretend like what you're going through is unusual somehow for the human race or for people that you know or what have you. The fact of the matter is the things of this life are oftentimes objectionable, and that's not entirely a bad thing. To a certain degree, that's a good thing because God is preparing us for heavenly things. And one of the best ways to prepare for heavenly things is to realize how unheavenly things here on earth are or can be sometimes. And I'm going to talk about pain first of all. Not the biggest point that I want to make here today, but there is a very real sense in which we as citizens of heaven living on earth temporarily, we are going to be subjected to pain, the hardships, the difficulties, the Lego blocks of life. What are we going to do about this? Well, there are certain things you can do. There's a certain, you know, there's Advil and Tylenol, and there's a certain amount of avoidance that you can engage in. You can try to avoid situations where you're likely to be in pain and things of that nature. But if you think somehow you're going to be able to go through the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years of your life and not be in significant pain, I have bad news for you. That's not the way that it works. And if somehow or another you manage to make it, say, 52 years in your life without suffering any kind of pain, you're about to have an awakening. Because I think this is Pensacola's fault. I was not struggling with this as a as a 46-year-old when I moved to this area. Not all that much. And all of a sudden, after 7-plus years in Florida, things hurt that didn't used to hurt. I'm in pain where I shouldn't be in pain. Where I haven't done anything wrong. There's nothing going amiss. I haven't hit myself with a hammer or anything like that. But I'm in pain. And I'm told that this is just what you kind of expect out of life. I'm not happy about that. But I'm learning that there is not a whole lot that I can do about that. And I am learning to appreciate that this is, in fact, life here on earth. It's maybe a little bit more sharp, a little bit more pointed, perhaps, than other examples. But in a real sense, you're not going to go 53 years without pain. That's the way it is in this life. And we have to find a way of dealing with this difficult circumstance in our life. And I realize that some people are in more pain than others, and some people are more in more regular pain, more constant pain than others. Some people have things at their disposal to help with the pain, and other people do not. I get that. But I also agree, I also understand, and I think we all agree, at least in concept, that pain is a universal constant, that we all suffer. And it is, to a certain degree, inevitable. We read from Romans chapter 8, in verse 22 and 23, how that this suffering is in a very real sense hardwired into the fabric of our existence here on earth. I don't know if Adam and Eve ever suffered pain before the fall. The text doesn't really describe that. I find it difficult to believe that they couldn't have suffered pain. But certainly they didn't suffer to the degree that we do, because that sin wasn't in the world. They had not fallen from grace yet. The difficulties of life that oftentimes cause pain, to a large degree, didn't exist back then. But they do now, and they have ever since then. And we realize that the creation is subjected to these hardships, these difficulties. And we as the children of God, as God's special creation, we don't suffer necessarily more than anybody else does, although sometimes we do. But we have a better understanding of these things. We hopefully are able to put them in perspective better. We realize that this is what this world is. And instead of causing us to despair, instead of causing us to lose hope or lose focus or lose faith, instead it simply causes us to double down on our faith. We realize that heaven is not going to be like this. And so every time we hurt, every time we ache, every time we itch, every time that the difficulties of life set upon us, we are just reminded that much more. Heaven's not going to have grass burrs. Heaven's not going to have mosquitoes. Heaven's not going to have, you know, bear attacks and all these other. You're not going to worry about these kind of things in heaven. And so therefore, pain is not the enemy, as it were. Pain is simply pain. It's what it is. It exists in this world. It has its downsides, obviously, but they're not all downsides. And therefore, pain is not something that is to be avoided at all costs. And I fear that people of my generation always wanted to pick on people who are younger than them. I realize that. Sorry, fellas. I apologize for this in advance. But I do believe that to a certain degree, perhaps younger people feel like this more than they used to feel. More than my generation did when we were young. That there is somehow a reality that we can achieve, a place we can get culturally or scientifically, where we will not have to worry about pain. Or pain will be a temporary, if that, difficulty that we deal with. And when we do have pain, the world stops. You know, it's over. I cannot cope with life because I have pain right now. And I will not cope with life. In fact, I'm determined not to cope with life until I don't have pain. That's the wrong attitude to take toward the difficulties of this life. Exactly, you know, however sharp or however constant your pain happens to be, whatever form it may take, physical pain, emotional pain, whatever, all of this serves a purpose. It is not the enemy. It is not something to be avoided at all costs. Avoid it, sure. I'm not opposed to avoiding pain. I'm okay with avoiding pain. Frankly, I try to avoid pain. But the world is not broken when I hurt. The world is just the world when I hurt. It's not a sign that we need to change necessarily. Sometimes it is. We have that built into us. I think we have an instinct. You put your hand on the hot stove, your hand hurts, you pull your hand off. That's just an instinct that you have. God made you that way so that you could avoid pain. We understand that. That's an instinct God put in us for a reason. But that does not mean that every time you hurt, that means you did something wrong or that somebody else did something wrong. There is not necessarily a connection there. Sometimes you just hurt because you're living in the world. Because the world's unfair, because bad things happen to good people or bad things happen to people in general. It doesn't mean that that the world is broken somehow. It does not make us victims. And I will be frank with you. This victim mentality that I see running rampant in our society really gets under my skin. The idea that somehow the world is ganging up on you. And I see this in teenagers. I see this in adults. I see this in senior citizens. The idea that somehow or another I have been hurt by the world. And it's I have nothing to do with it. It's not my fault. Maybe it isn't your fault. But that somehow I'm being picked on. And there's nothing I can do about it. It's something fundamentally wrong with my life. There's nothing that I can do about it. There's no control that I can exercise. All I can do is just sit around and whine about it. That is the opposite of the attitude that the Christian should have, that we see in the Scriptures. The one who is not to do everything without murmuring or complaining, that Paul talks about in Philippians chapter 2. We need to have an attitude of joy, an attitude of work, an attitude of endurance and patience and long-suffering. Now, I'm not real fond of the word long-suffering for reasons that ought to be relatively evident, right? I'm not a big fan of short-suffering. I certainly don't like long-suffering. But this is not only part of the world, but it can actually serve a purpose in our life. Becoming long-suffering, becoming a person who is able to endure the pain and the difficulties and the hardships of this life. We have to find a way to develop pain tolerance. And you can talk about physical pain, you can talk about emotional pain, you can talk about social pain, whatever kind of, however application you want to use in this will be just fine. But whatever you're suffering in this life, I would like to do what I can as an individual within reason, within my abilities, limited though they may be, to alleviate your suffering. And if there's something that I can do, let me know. But I will tell you right now, I will almost certainly not be able to take all of it away. In fact, probably nobody can. The better approach is to find a way to deal with our pain. I'm not saying that you don't try to alleviate it. But while you are suffering, while bad things are happening to you, accept this as part of life under God's Son and find a way to cope. Find a way to deal with it. And one of the great ways that we have as Christians that people out in the world do not have, a tremendous advantage, is that we can put this on Jesus. And we can lean on Him. Whatever, be anxious for nothing, Peter says, 1 Peter chapter 5, in everything with petition and thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. The peace of God, which passes all understanding, I'm quoting from Philippians chapter 4 here, will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. 1 Peter chapter 5 says that we are supposed to humble ourselves, casting all our anxiety on Him, verse number 7, because He cares for you. I got my scriptures mixed up there for a second. Apologize. We cast all of our anxiety on Him because He cares about us. The Apostle Paul did that with regard to his thorn in the flesh, remember. He petitioned the Lord 3 times that it be removed. The simple approach, and that's the one we always want. We always want the simple approach to pain, right? The simple approach is make the pain go away. And Jesus is capable of that. So why not pray, right? We ought to pray. Lord, please remove this pain from my life, whatever it happens to be. And sometimes Jesus says yes, and sometimes Jesus says no. That's not good news and bad news. That's 2 different versions of good news. The good news, A, is that we don't have any pain anymore, and we give God the glory for that. And the good news, B, where Paul finds himself, is that I have another opportunity to trust in Jesus. I have another opportunity to acknowledge my need for Jesus. The more I suffer, the more I am driven to my knees to pray. And the more I realize how much I need God. And that's a good thing. So bring on the pain. Because I'm glad to have my thorn. I don't want my thorn removed anymore. Because the more weak I am in the flesh, the stronger I become in Jesus Christ. Pain helps us become stronger, building up that resistance, that determination that we have as Christians. I love the text in Hebrews chapter 12. I have not had a whole lot of experience with regard to physical injury and recovery and things of that nature. Many of you have. Some of you are going through similar things actually as we speak. And the process of healing, the process of getting to the other side, sometimes can feel worse than the injury. And our instinct is just to, I'd rather just stay miserable where I am rather than becoming even more miserable on my path to some other place. And what we need to do is trust in God. Trust in Jesus that He is working something in us that is wonderful. But it's painful in the short term. And sometimes this is the way it is. He says in verse number 11, all discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful but sorrowful, yet to those who have been trained by it, afterward it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. Therefore strengthen the hands that are weak and the knees that are feeble, and make straight paths for your feet, so that the limb which is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. Now sometimes the suffering, sometimes the pain of this life is general, and sometimes it's specific. And I think that the writer here is probably talking about some specific pain. That God has a lesson that he's trying to teach you. And maybe that's the case with somebody. Maybe you're in a difficult situation specifically because God needs you to work on some specific thing, and it's a painful process to get from point A to point B. That's the case sometimes. But sometimes it's more general than that. Sometimes you're suffering pain just because you're living in the world. You're suffering pain just because you're here. And this also is a process. And if it's not doing anything other than taking you from earth to heaven, that process, although painful, is useful and needful for us. And so therefore we give ourselves over to this pain, we give ourselves over to this process, and allow it to work God's kind of character in us. And I say this over and over again, you have a choice in this matter. You can take your circumstances and use them to either drive you closer to God or further away from God. That's your choice. You have complete and total control over this. No one has anything to say about this except for you. So you can use your hardships, you can use your difficulty, you can use your pain to help you become more dependent on God and find your limbs strengthened. You don't feel strong in the moment, but God is working something in you. You are getting to where you need to be. Or you can quit. You can be a complainer. You can be a quitter. You can be a half-hearted servant and refuse to get involved in anything that causes you discomfort and never get where God is trying to take you. We need to be stronger than that. We need to find a way to build up tolerance. And there is no point at which this tolerance becomes optional. I've suffered enough. We've all said that we've suffered enough. We've all put it on Facebook, or we've all told our best friend or our wife, or, you know what, I'm done. I've had it. I cannot take this anymore. I know that God wants me to suffer. I know that there's a difficulty and a hardship and a lesson at the end of it, but I've learned all the lessons I care to learn. I'm done with lessons. I want the pain to go away. I have maxed out on lessons. Well, hate to break it to you, but you haven't. There's obviously at least one lesson you need to learn, and that's this one. And there are probably others also. We need to learn humility. We need to learn patience. We need to learn tolerance. And on we can go. And it may very well be that God, combined with this world, may choose a path for you to get to where you need to be that is objectionable to you. I'm sorry about that. But there's not a whole lot we can do about that. Pray to God, certainly. But whether we get the relief or we do not get the relief, we trust that He is watching over us, and no matter how bad things may get, we can and we will get to the other side. You may have one of those Job days where you only thought your problems were starting when you lost all your stuff. You know, and then you find out, oh no, there's even worse news. It gets worse. Oh, but you thought you were done. No, it gets even worse than that. I pardon the Clinton reference here. I feel your pain. Yeah, I've been there to a certain degree, maybe not some as much as some of you, but I understand how the world works, and I sympathize. But we can and we must be strong in these moments and not give ourselves an excuse for getting weak. Similarly, I'll give you a second point. Learning how to tolerate ill treatment. Living life as a Christian is inconvenient. You put a burden on your neighbors. You put a burden of guilt on your neighbors, a burden of responsibility on your neighbors that makes them uncomfortable. It makes them annoyed. And they tend to take that out on you. If you don't know what I'm talking about, hang around. You'll see it eventually. It is the world's fallback approach to good influences. If we are trying to drag the world, our friends in the world, kicking and screaming if necessary, into a relationship with Jesus Christ, we're trying to get them to give up all their bad habits and adopt all these good habits, the things that are working so well for us. They don't like doing that. They object to that. They put up a fuss. And they will lash out. Sometimes they will hurt you because they are determined for bad things to come to themselves rather than good things. And you don't get that. I don't get that. It seems completely and totally unreasonable from our perspective. One of the on my podcast this last week, I was talking about one particular game that we play where you're capturing these little animals and putting them in captivity. You're blessing the animals. This is the best thing that ever happened to these animals. And they don't like that. They will do whatever you can. Quite frankly, your family dog who loves you so much, you open the door at the wrong time, he may be gone forever. You know, he loves his freedom. He loves doing what he wants to do. Not my dog. My dog is scared to death of flying leaves. He'll be fine. But maybe yours won't. We're trying to exercise compassion and love and patience and tolerance and all these wonderful things for these people who absolutely could not care less. They wish we wouldn't do it. And they will make your life miserable as a result of this. And at some point you say, you know what? I'm done. I refuse to be treated like this anymore. I am being oppressed. I'm being afflicted for no good reason. Simply because I'm trying to do the right thing, I'm done. I'm not going to do this anymore. The fact of the matter is, you are going to suffer ill treatment in this life. Not despite being Christian, because you're a Christian. Specifically because you're a Christian. And when this happens, it hurts. I've gone through it, I'm sure you have too. It hurts us in our heart, like pain hurts us in our body. And there's nothing we can do about it. Except quitting, you can do that. But you don't want to quit. You don't want to quit on your friends, your family members. And so you endure, and you push through, and it hurts even more. And finally, at some point, we just decide there must be just something fundamentally wrong. The world is not supposed to work like this. I find it constantly amazing that we talk all the time about living in Satan's world. I talk about this a lot, that we're living in Satan's world. Most of the people who are living in it are devoted to Satan. They may not see it that way, but that's what they are. The devil is running things, and bad things happen to good people in that context. Well, why in the world wouldn't it work that way? What are you expecting? Living in a world that's devoted to hellish things while we are trying to pursue heavenly things. The world is determined to break us down, and it will. Or certainly it'll try. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 14 and 15 talks about how that which is crooked cannot be straightened, that which is lacking cannot be counted. That's the way the world is. It has been since Solomon's day and before. It will continue to be that way. And no amount of good behavior on your part is going to change that. That's not fair. Well, you know what? As my parents used to tell me, as I tell my children, as you may have heard once or twice, life's not fair. Bad things happen to good people, despite them being good people, because they're good people sometimes. That doesn't mean the world is going wrong. That doesn't mean anything is broken. That means you're aware. That means you're awake. And finally coming into grips with the fact of the matter that has been in existence all the time. And it's certainly not an opportunity for us to engage in revenge or sin ourselves. I think Hollywood has done us a real disservice with regard to this kind of thing, because we've been trained, and I've been trained my entire life, to look at injustice in terms of something that needs to be fixed. And so the kid is being bullied at school and picked on and beaten up on and milk poured on his head and all this kind of thing, and we, oh, poor kid. And then one of these days the kid gets up the gumption and he doesn't bring a gun to school or something like that, but it's something a little bit more moderate than that. He'll pull a prank of his own. And the school bully winds up falling in the garbage dumpster, getting, you know, falling in the cow manure pile or whatever happens to be. And we all, he got what was coming to him. That's a good thing. A good person does something bad to a bad person to make him feel bad about being bad. And we think that's an appropriate response. That's revenge. That's good. No, it's not good. We're told specifically, Romans chapter 12 and verses 17 and following, that revenge is God's business. Justice is God's business. You may have recourse within the law to pursue justice, to pursue good things, as it were, an equitable outcome. But ultimately, this is God's business. He says, starting in verse number 17, never pay back evil for evil to anyone. Respect what is right in the sight of all men. If possible, so far as depends on you, be at peace with all men. Never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. But if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink. For in so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome with evil, but overcome evil with good. You say, well, you know what? I tried that for about 20 years. I tried heaping coals of fire on my enemy's head, and they just took those coals of fire and dumped them in my lap. They did not change. They did not turn. They did not repent. This plan did not work. Well, we have a confused notion of what work means here. This is not saying here, I don't think, that if you will be nice to bad people, the bad people will quit being bad people. I think it works that way sometimes. And maybe that's part of what is being discussed here, but I don't think that's the main point. This is not talking about fixing the world. This is about fixing you. You being the kind of person that you ought to be. That's the way the gospel always is. You heard me saying this all the time. I keep reading the Bible hoping Jesus is going to fix the world, and he keeps trying to fix me. I get aggravated at that. I want him to fix the world. And he's not fixing the world. The world is the way it is. What is fixable, what is my responsibility, is changing my attitude toward the world. Not becoming worldly myself, not becoming evil myself, but trusting that God does in fact have his hand on the switch, that God is in fact in charge of all these things, and it will work out for the best. I know sometimes it feels like God has quit, that God is not there for you anymore. That's why you have to wait on the Lord. Right? In Psalm 27, verse 14, wait for the Lord, or wait on the Lord. Be strong, let your heart take courage. Yes, wait for the Lord. Allow him to have his way in the world. I've been waiting for 53 years. How much longer do I have to wait? I don't know. A little bit longer, apparently. Maybe your whole life. There are souls before the throne, before the altar in the Revelation scene, Revelation chapter 6, who lived their entire life and died at the end of it because of their faith, and they're still waiting. Maybe that'll be you and me. I don't know. What I do know is this, that no matter how much injustice affects you, and no matter how it affects you, how much of it there is, how long you have to wait, it never becomes appropriate for you to be a weaker Christian than you are. Your approach is always that you need to be a stronger Christian than you are. We have to develop a tolerance toward ill treatment. I'm not saying you get to the point where it doesn't matter anymore, you don't care, you don't notice. I'm not saying that. Because there's usually a positive response, the heaping coals of fire on their head, as it were. There's usually something positive you can do in response to this ill treatment that perhaps may work something in their life or work something in the life of somebody else. Being tolerant of this means not allowing it to break us down, not allowing it to make us weaker and more frail in our faith, in our behavior. We expect this. hopefully at some point this quits taking us by surprise. When people who are opposed to God, who are opposed to Jesus, wind up opposing us. That's the way it's supposed to work. Frankly, if it doesn't work that way, something's wrong. Something on our end. Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 4, "Beloved, do not be surprised," verse 12, "at the fiery ordeal among you which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you, but to the degree you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also the revelation of His glory, you may also rejoice with exultation," going through verse number 13 there. This is not some strange thing. This is an ordinary thing. Doesn't make it fair. Doesn't make it right. Doesn't mean we shouldn't hope that it changes. We're always hoping that wicked people start acting less wickedly, start acting more righteously. We're always in favor of that. But don't expect that at some point some switch is going to go off and all the bad people are going to, like in the big scene at the end of the movie where all the bad people combine and they put their hands around, the arms around the guy they've been oppressing all this time and lift him up on the shoulder and, "Yay, we really like him after all, and we celebrate, yay." I've been the beat up on kid. I've been the weak kid. It doesn't work that way. That's not the way it works. They spit on you and you laugh about it. That's the way it works. And they keep doing it. And we're upset about that. We're not happy about that. But we will learn to tolerate, because we have our eyes on bigger things. We have our eyes on spiritual things, on heavenly things. We have our eyes on Jesus Christ Himself. Hebrews chapter 12. Again, verse number 1 and 2. "Therefore, since we have such a great cloud of witnesses surrounding us," and he's just talked about people who were sawn in half because of their faith, people who were afflicted tremendously because of their faith, stoned, abandoned, hated, abused, killed in all kinds of ways, starting with Abel and going all the way through the end. It says, "Since you're surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses," he says, "let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." Do you think Jesus' journey was ever difficult? Do you think he ever encountered hardship? Was he ever persecuted because of what he was trying to do? Did he ever get discouraged at this sort of thing? Of course. Every page of the text that we read in Jesus' life is like this. And he pushes on because he has his eyes on bigger things. And likewise, we focus on what he has done for us. And we push toward bigger things. We endure. We're not crazy about the cross that we have to bear in the short term. But we do it because we know that greater things are waiting for us after this life is over. There is no breaking point. There is no point at which, you know what, he's gone too far. And now we're going to, if we were Popeye, we'd eat our spinach and we'd, the kids even know who Popeye is these days. And we beat up on the bad guy and yay, we win and happily ever after. No, that's not the way it works. God is always going to be the hero. Jesus is always going to be the hero. He's going to be the one that works all this out. No matter how bad things may get for us, we continue to be his kind of person. We continue to be like Jesus was himself, all the way to the cross and past. That's what we want for ourselves. That's what God wants for us. Now, before we close up, let me flip this around a little bit. I find it interesting that we have such difficulty, such hardship, such challenge, building up tolerance to these things that we've been talking about for the last 20 minutes or so. We struggle with finding a level of tolerance for the difficulties of this life. And yet, when we talk about sin instead, we find it increasingly easy to tolerate. Now, why is that? Why is it that the legitimately bad things in this life, not physically bad, spiritually bad things in this life, are just as oppressive and just as objectionable, if not more so, than these carnal things, these physical things? And we build up a tremendous tolerance to these things. Television is the easy way to demonstrate this. In our day, we're able to go on Hulu or whatever service you have these days and watch TV shows, go to TV Land or one of these other channels, and watch shows from the 70s, for instance, shows that I grew up on. and notice what is talked about and what is not talked about. And the language that's used and the language that is not used. And remember, that's the way it was when I was a teenager. That's the way it was when I was growing up. We remember the shows. I could give you some shows, titles if I wanted to, that were edgy. That mom and dad were not crazy about us watching. And in fact, they may have just put their foot down. You're not going to watch that show. That show has divorced people on it. We don't tolerate that in our house. And then you turn on the modern day, and you see what's going on now, and what we have grown to tolerate. And I'm not suggesting here that you watch a TV show with a divorced person on, you're going to hell. That's not my point here. My point is that sin has this habit of coercing us into accepting more and more and more, and objecting less and less and less. Sin does not hit us in our flesh. Sin does not hit us in our heart, not primarily. Sin hits us in our spirit, which should be the most important thing. And the irony behind this one is avoidable. You can, in fact, avoid the impact of sin in your life. You can't avoid pain. You can't avoid injustice. But those things aren't really all that important anyway. Sin is tremendously important. And you can avoid that. And yet, instead, what we do is we build up a tolerance for it. Sometimes we decide, well, it's just a little bit, and maybe it's not that big of a deal in small doses. Paul's words in 1 Corinthians 5 verse 6 come up in a different context there, but not all that different. In 1 Corinthians 5, remember, there is a sinner in the midst. He's guilty of the sin, and the people are celebrating their ability to tolerate sin. And Paul says, instead, a little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough. If you have tolerance for this kind of sin, before too long you're going to have tolerance for this other kind of sin. And before too long, you're not taking a stand against any sin. And we see that in the so-called Christian world today, where they set a precedent 50 years ago that they were not going to take a stand against some particular sin or some small group of sins, and now we don't know what sin is. We have very prominent so-called Christian evangelists getting up there who steadfastly refuse to talk about sin, who will not condemn anything, up to and including people who have not named the name of Jesus Christ. I think we need to stay positive about this. Well, I have no problem with staying positive. But we can't get positive to the point where we ignore the existence of negative things. Sin is real. And it's not qualifiable. It's not to be measured against other sins. James talks about this in his epistle a little bit in the context of playing favorites. They're showing discrimination against poorer people and in favor of richer people, despite the fact that the rich people tend to be their oppressors. They tend to be their enemies. James deals with this theme a lot in his epistle. And he talks about loving your neighbor as yourself there in verse number 8. He says, if you show partiality, verse 9, you are committing sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. Well, it's just partiality. I'm not killing anybody. Surely it's not that big of a deal, right? If I can manage to avoid murder and yet I'm guilty of partiality, well, in the big picture, that's not such a bad thing. Well, maybe as the world measures such things, maybe not. Maybe you're more likely to go to prison for one than for the other. But according to the scripture, the text says, whoever keeps the whole law, verse 10, and yet stumbles at one point, he's become guilty of all. For he who said, do not commit adultery, also said, do not commit murder. Now, if you do not commit adultery, but do commit murder, you have become a transgressor of the law. There's a very real sense, James says, in which you are either a person who respects and abides by and submits to God's law, or you are a person who does not. It's one or the other. Well, I'm submitting in 10 areas, but not in one area. That means you're breaking the laws you feel like breaking. And you're not breaking the laws you don't feel like breaking. What's so noble about that? Everybody does that. The only thing that a true subject of Jesus Christ is going to be able to do is to submit to every aspect, every law, and turn every part of your life over to his control. Saying, well, I can have my token vice. I don't know where that expression came from, but I wish it would go back to where it came from. There's no such thing as a token vice. I have one bad area of my life, and the rest of my life is great. Well, in the first place, you're probably flattering yourself. And in the second place, there's no such thing as one sin that's okay to indulge in. Nor is it atoned by our willingness to suffer consequences. You know, in traffic court, if you're willing to put up with fines and perhaps worse than fines for speeding or running stop signs or whatever happens to be, the judge doesn't have anything against you personally. You want to drive 100 miles an hour, drive 100 miles an hour. You get caught, you have to pay a fine. And you pay your fine and you go your way. And you may decide that it's worth $300 or $400 or $500, whatever it is these days. That's a good bargain. For 6 months of speeding, I got caught one time and I had to pay this. I'm not sorry at all. I paid my penalty and we're done. That may be how you feel about this. I don't know. But if that's the way you feel about sin, you have a poor understanding of what consequences for sin really are. Well, I cheated on my wife, and it destroyed my marriage. And I'm not happy about that, but, you know, maybe it wasn't all that great a marriage anyway. My kids are tough. They're going to be able to put up with this. In the big picture, it's going to be a manageable situation. I'm going to have to pay a lot of child support and all that, but you know what? At the end of the day, it works out okay for me. And so therefore, somehow your sin becomes okay because you're willing to deal with the consequences of your sin. And I'll grant you, a lot of people are not willing to deal with the consequences of their sin. So maybe you're a step up as far as that goes. But the consequences of sin that we deal with in this life are only preparatory. They're a warning to us because of the real consequences that are coming after this life is over. If you can live a sinful life and live with yourself, that's not the main issue. The main issue is whether Jesus is going to live with it. And the text says over and over again that he is not. What we need to do is build up a sin tolerance. I like the way that James refers to it in James chapter 1, verse 21. Rather, I think the Old King James Version has the word superfluity or superfluity, however you pronounce that. And maybe the idea is that you have a cup of coffee that's on a saucer, and you're pouring the cup full of coffee, and some you're a little bit over-enthusiastic, and some of it sloshes over, and that superfluous aspect of the coffee brims over, and now you made a mess for yourself, and you shouldn't have done that. Now you have to clean that up. And that excess, as it were, that's in the saucer now, that's the superfluity of wickedness. That's not what James is saying. The text in the New American Standard Bible says, putting aside all filthiness and all that remains of wickedness, in humility receive the word implanted, which is able to save your soul. What he's talking about is not just overflow of wickedness. He's talking about residue of wickedness. Taylor made me some coffee last week or at some point, and I drank the coffee, and there's some grounds left over in the bottom because our filters are not very good. And I just kind of left it out there on the table because that's what I do. And so at the, you know, a day later or whatever, I come back in this cup, the stuff is still down there in the bottom of it. It's not an empty cup. There's still some stuff left there. It needs to be clean. And it's going to stay there until something is done about it. Until we get rid of what remains of the coffee. That's what we need to be doing with our spiritual lives. We need to be scouring ourselves, getting rid of whatever is left over of our sin. But look at all the things I quit. Look at all these things I gave up. Good for you. God bless you for that, and may your tribe increase. But you're not done yet. Is there anything that remains? Well, yeah, but it's not really that big of a deal. Yes, it is. All of it is a big deal. All of your sin is a big deal. Tolerance is going to come with an attitude of indifference. I fear that this is the problem. We just don't think sin is that big of a deal. Or maybe this particular aspect of sin is not that big of a deal. Tolerance comes from exposure. We've just been seeing so much of it in this wicked world that we're living in that seems to our eyes to be getting worse every day. I'm not sure it is, but it seems like it anyway, and we're exposed to so much of it on the internet and the news and all. It just gets to be so much. How can we possibly withstand this? We withstand it the same way that other cultures have withstood it. And you give into it just like other cultures have given into it. It's your choice. Simply because we are bombarded with sin does not mean that we have to give in to sin. Tolerance comes with laziness as much as anything else. We're just not working very hard at this. How much do you want to avoid sin? You remember the fellow in the Proverbs who's just doesn't feel like getting out of bed in any given day, and he just kind of rolls over, and his farm goes to pot. Not overnight, but over a period of weeks, over a period of months, bad things happen. Bad things are necessarily going to happen if you're lazy about it. And the more casual you are about your spiritual life, the more casual you are about standing against the evils of this day, the worse things are going to get. We have to break this down. We have to ignore, we have to push through indifference, learn how to care about sin. We need to ignore how pervasive the world happens to be with their sin, and just be as righteous as we possibly can. Be lights in an increasingly dark world, and work hard at it. Give ourselves to this. I know it's tiring. I know that it seems like we're swimming upstream sometimes. But God will empower you to do this. Jesus will give you the strength that you need. He will mount you up with wings like eagles, the text says in Isaiah 40, verse number 31. You may be saying, well, my wings are on back order. I haven't got my wings yet. Well, maybe not. But God will empower you if you will allow Him to do that. If you will build up this tolerance toward the things that need to be tolerated, and if you will fight off an attitude of tolerance toward the things that cannot be tolerated. And don't get our stuff mixed up. God will help you through this process. You're going to have to work at it. It's going to be difficult. It's going to take some time probably. You're going to fail from time to time. But God will empower you to succeed if you will give yourself half of a chance. So work through the things that need to be worked through. Power through them with God's help. Stand opposed to the things that need to be opposed. With all diligence. With God's help, you can do that too. Learn what needs to be tolerated and what cannot be tolerated. We're going to give you an opportunity to respond to the Lord's invitation if you need to do so. If there's something that is amiss in your life that of a spiritual nature that we can help with, we urge you to make that right with God. Make that right with your brethren if necessary. Whether that is by helping you into the water of baptism, whether that is by asking for spiritual help in some struggle that you're facing, whatever it happens to be. Allow us to give you the encouragement that you need while we stand and sing to encourage you at this time.